happy to see all these smiling faces tonight. And I'm so happy to have you here. Tonight, I thought it would be really interesting to talk about love and wisdom and the unity of love and wisdom, which is experiential, so it can't be talked about, so it'll be a really short little session. So I'll try to lead up to it slowly. Before I get into that, though, I've been meaning to just take a few minutes, and maybe each session, since some people are newer to our group than others, and some people may be new to meditation. Linda is leading us into the process of meditation, and I wanted to speak briefly of some of the mechanics. We're doing sitting meditation. There are many kinds of meditation. And we're doing silent sitting meditation, and the body in this case is a support. So there's some benefit in having a few tricks for the body. First and foremost, being comfortable, and at least as important, being upright. Doesn't matter really whether you're sitting or sitting on a chair, sitting on the floor, comfort is important. But also, it's been found over thousands of years that it's good to have a straight, erect spine. And it's ideal, if medical conditions allow it, to have the spine unsupported. In other words, not leaning against the back of the chair. And what people have found over thousands of years of experimentation is that if we're too supported, drowsiness occurs and the mind gets more drifty. So the unsupported vertical back and just some alignment of posture allow breathing to be freer and allow the mind to be less drifty. As far as details of how the mouth is, how the eyes are, things like that, it's up to you. Some people have the lips slightly parted. Some traditions insist on it, with the breath going in and out both mouth and nose. Many people meditate with the mouth closed, personal preference. Same with the eyes, although various traditions do it differently. In general, whatever you like. Starting out, there's some benefit to having the eyes closed because of less distraction. You can concentrate more on the breathing and the arising of thoughts and emotions and sounds. And then it's up to you whether your eyes are opened or closed. Opened, most people have looking slightly down, like 3 to 10 feet ahead of you on the floor. If you tend to be drowsy, having eyes open during meditation is a great assist. And then if you get drowsy despite that, looking straight ahead, and if you're still getting drowsy, looking up tends to help. As far as the breathing, natural. But if drowsiness occurs that isn't even cured by eye position, pausing on the out-breath a little bit can help keep you more alert. So those are just general guidelines. Most of you know them already. If you don't, it might be of some help during your meditation. So, most people, most of us, when we first come to meditation, come to the Dharma, come to a Sangha, are coming because we want something. So it's about me. Sometimes that want is pretty unformed. It could just be that life is going well, but there's a feeling there's something more. Or it could be coming out of pain where nothing's working right, looking for another solution. But the general orientation is, I need something, I want something, I want to get something. Narrow focus. And most people show up in a room like this for the first time. We're human beings. We get nervous when we come into a new group of other human beings, and so we clamp down even further. We're nervous, we're self-conscious. Again, more about me, 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 me. And then another kind of attachment that we all have pretty much at first is that we hear somebody talking, pretending to be a teacher. And we think, oh, that's where I'm going to get it. I'm going to get it from the teacher. So we're grasping toward the teacher and the teachings. But as time goes on, the laws of impermanence hopefully influence our practice, and we start to have little insights about how our mind works. If meditation is working, we're starting to see some of, to our horror, we're seeing some of what our mind does. First step. And then as we are able to have more reflection, more self-reflection, sometimes we get more insights about how our mind is causing our suffering. And so that's a little bit of an opening. It's not so much grasping, not so much narrow focus. There's a little bit of opening. And then as we start to realize how we cause our own suffering, there's often a further opening as compassion grows for other people who are suffering. And you can see, oh my gosh, I can see how they're causing their own suffering, and I can't do anything about it. And so compassion grows even more. And then as we develop in our relationship with the Dharma and the Sangha and the teachings, we see that we move slowly from wanting to get to a participatory giving. We see that actually showing up in Sangha helps feed the Sangha. We contribute energy, we contribute presence. We actually affect the field, further opening. And we start to see that our participation in this is not so much about getting teachings and getting realization as participating in this indefinable process of the Sangha, rubbing up against each other, loving each other, hating each other, being irritated constantly, and we find the teacher there, and we see that it's an interactive process. We're giving, we're supporting, not even necessarily taking on a formal role in the Sangha, but just by showing up and participating in this dance of rubbing off each other and having normal human reactions and finding the teacher there and supporting each other in this process. We've gone from this very narrow focus of what can I get to a participation that's like a dance. So it's layers and layers of opening. And then if we are really diligent in the process and if we actually are able to sit with our own minds and our own emotions and our own being and create the right conditions, we might get touched by grace now and then. It actually isn't rare. What the trick is not that these little insights or moments of grace happen or don't happen. They're happening a lot. The trick is recognizing. And that recognizing takes even more receptivity, more opening. So as you see, what we're getting at here is that there's just all these layers of opening. And then we start to recognize what's been happening our whole life, that there are little glimpses of the truth. Ajahn says that the reason we even show up and come through that door in the first place is that the truth is seeking the truth. Our true nature, who we really are, is seeking itself and our dissatisfaction with life, even if we're a trillionaire and have a dozen houses and have everything, the dissatisfaction, the sense of, is this all there is from this sense that the truth wants to be found. Our true nature wants to be recognized. Our true nature wants to join the true nature, which is everything. So Linda used the term coming home, and that's coming home in the sense of where the Dharma is actually taking us. Along the way, we fall in love with the teachings, and we fall in love with the container of the Sangha, no matter how much we get irritated by little things that come up. And then in this opening, we have glimpses of our true nature, which is indistinguishable from what you can call the way of abiding, the way all things abide, the natural state, which is just so descriptive. It's the way things are, the natural state of everything, which is same outside and inside. And it's also called non-dual timeless awareness. It's also called God. I want to explain to those of you who might be alarmed by my use of the word God, I'll frequently refer to God. The Buddhists, as a religion or a philosophy, don't deny that there is a God. Buddhism just denies that there is a creator God. The way we were taught in Sunday school is God created the world. And the Buddhists, philosophers and scholars and practitioners and yogis who've actually experienced the natural state know that that can't be true, because if there's a creator, if there's a creation, there's a creator and there's a separation. And the natural state is one of non-separation. So when I use the word God, I'm not using the word to denote a male creator God in flowing robes who is running the whole show. That's somebody who's standing outside of it. And the natural state is experienced as total unity, total congruity, total non-separation, which is the opposite of that narrow little focus we came in the room with the first time. And that is indistinguishable from love. Indistinguishable conceptually, indistinguishable emotionally, indistinguishable physically. It's love. My wife Carol dissuaded me for a long time about using the word love because it's so misunderstood. And then when she realized I was going to go ahead and use it tonight, she handed me one of her favorite books and said, "You better read this." And it's a book by Bell Hooks. Some of you might know Bell Hooks. She's a brilliant social commentator, journalist, Buddhist, who, back when Carol bought the book in 15 years ago or so, it was very hard to find. She went to City Lights bookstore to find it in San Francisco, where all of the forbidden books are kept. And Bell wrote this book about love. And she is a brilliant scholar and gathered a lot of quotes and a lot of statements. And she had one statement that just really riveted me, because it was exactly what I wanted to convey tonight, which is that any spiritual awakening is an awakening to love. That's really all I needed to say tonight, is that one thing. Any spiritual awakening is an awakening of love or to love, I can't remember. And so what is love, the way we're talking about it? My sister, who's an avid student of Richard Rohr, who is brilliant, learned through him or his Sangha that one aspect of spiritual love is intimacy, and she was taught to think of it as into me see, which is certainly a quality of love. Into me see. So we've talked a lot about non-separation. Into me see is part of this sense that one gets when one recognizes the natural state, because you're looking at a mirror. When you look at the natural state, everything becomes a mirror, and you become a mirror to everything. Talk about intimacy. Carol leads us in the refuge prayer before this little talk and before our stretch. And refuge goes from the banal and venal all the way to the sublime. We can take refuge in sex, money, power, aggression, rock and roll. Or we can take refuge in progressively higher or more refined or more open truths. And when we recognize the natural state, we see that there's nothing else worth taking refuge in. And that sense is accompanied by a recognition of the loving, holding environment, which is the natural state, which is our true nature. So once again, that term that Frank introduced us to some time ago, the loving, holding environment, when we first think about it or hear about it, we think it's something out there. I want that. And then we realize that the recognition itself of the natural state of our true nature is the loving, holding environment as ourselves, as I shouldn't say created, but the more we recognize our true nature, the greater this loving, holding environment is. And the loving part of it isn't fake, and it isn't dualistic. And then the one other thing that's worth saying about this is that this act of recognition, this not even an act, this experience of recognition of how things really are, is impeded mostly in practitioners by the fact that it's just too simple. The natural state, the true nature, God, is just too simple. And so we have a glimpse and we discard it as saying, well, that's not flashy enough to be what I'm looking for. So the simplicity and intimacy of this truth of our own being is sometimes the reason we can't see it. In fact, it's often the reason we can't see it. And that's like love, too. On any level, sometimes we're surprised by just how simple and unornate and elaborate true love is. It's simple. I told you that words fail to describe something like this, but there are descriptors for the natural state, for awareness, for recognition. One is ineffability. Ineffable because it can't be defined. So you can toss out all the words I've used tonight. Another is unobstructed, completely open, not bounded by anything. Boundlessness. Another is that you don't have to go seeking for it. It's spontaneously present. It's already here. You can't call it. You can't bring it in the door. It's already here. In fact, there's nothing else. And then last but not least, that sense of separation is gone, which is part of the loving quality of it. So we get glimpses. And sometimes we say, no, this can't be too simple, too unelaborate, too ordinary. But as we start to accept these little glimpses of our true nature, we feel this open, loving quality that's can't be faked and can't be missed. So enough words. Why don't we stand up and stretch a little bit more? And I'd like to pass out a little list of quotes regarding this that you might or might not find helpful. I tried to get some quotations from various traditions, and I can warn you that not all of you will find anything satisfying in this list. But maybe some of you will find something satisfying in this list. Gina. I like quotes, because sometimes in a few words they can convey just a whole lot of information. I forgot to ask if anybody had brought in a question before our session today. If you had, I don't want to ignore it, so please pass it on.
Can I share a moment of grace? It's not a question.
Please.
I love what you said about it. It's simple and it was a moment of grace. And I was in the hospital visiting a dying friend with cancer. I get in the elevator to go down to the lobby and I'm tearing up and crying. And a fellow just walks in as the door's about to close and he's crying. He's about 30 or so. And I said, boy, this is really hard. And I just went like that. And then he hugged me and we hugged in the elevator all the way down. And we got out of the elevator and I said, may I pray for the person that you're here for? And he said, yes, it's my aunt. I'd love you to do that. And then he said, can I pray for your person? And I said, great. And then we both held each other again. I mean, the whole thing took 3 minutes. And my heart just overflowed. It was so amazing. And then we just left. And that was the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a precious moment.
Thank you. Talk about intimacy. I was thinking of saying something about each of these, and then I thought that would be really boring. But I thought that maybe you all might have comments or questions about some of these, like, how the heck does this apply to anything else? My original thought was that I would just hand this out at the end of our hour and you could take it home and see what you thought of it. It may be of no use at all, but if there's anything in there that sparks a question or an insight, maybe we could hear your comment.
Well, I have this one. We can find the love our hearts long for, but not until we let go. The grief about the love we lost long ago. So I guess what does she mean about the grief about the love we lost long ago?
The sentence is a little awkward. It's more like the English omit the of in there. But she's pointing out that many people are blocked in their ability to love because of past injury.
Okay.
Past trauma, past loss. And she's saying there that it takes an opening. Again, I'm stressing that word, but we constrict around grief. So where we have felt unloved, unwanted, untended, unappreciated, unwanted in the past, it, as long as we're caught on the horns of that injury, it becomes really hard to love. So I thought that was a beautiful quote, just looking at how we can get in our own way through past injury if we constrict down around that injury. So it's again pointing at the opening. I put in the last one for the environmentalists and nature lovers in the group, but it's really opaque translation of Dogen, who was opaque even in his original Japanese. But this last quote is one of my favorite, showing the interdependence and interrelatedness of everything animate and inanimate, and how everything supports the practitioner, and the practice supports everything. A little bit like the maturation into the role of the Sangha, where the Sangha supports us as we're on our training wheels, and we support the Sangha by showing up and giving our energy and our practice to it. In this case, Dogen is saying even the rocks and stones, fences, are part of the whole web, and we support it with our practice and our insights, and it supports us. And I think it's just beautiful.
Are you differentiating love from compassion, and if so, how are you separating those two?
The question is, am I separating love from compassion? And if so, how and why, I guess. And yes, to a degree I am. Within the natural state or within the divinity, there is no separation. And the four qualities you can speak of in that sense are love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. In the immeasurables. But we commonly talk about the unity of wisdom and compassion. That's heard all the time, wisdom and compassion. And I thought it would be important to stress the love, too. Compassion is where you are more concerned with the suffering of others than the suffering of yourself. And in Buddhism, love is being more concerned with the welfare of a person than the welfare of yourself. Subtly different. I also thought to use love tonight because it's an emotion that we all have experienced on various levels, from selfish love to hormonal love to more and more open and rarefied forms of love. So it's something we can all relate to on some level. Compassion maybe has been harder for some people. Certainly if you've been badly traumatized in your life, compassion is perhaps, arguably, a little less accessible than love. But ultimately, it's hard to separate love, compassion, joy, and equanimity, but we do, just to talk about these different flavors of the natural state. And I think that when we talk about love in this tradition, the Vipassana tradition, we often talk about it in terms of loving kindness and loving kindness practice, and that's dualistic. Just by definition, I'm giving this loving kindness to somebody, and getting this loving kindness from myself or others. And the love that is part of this natural state of recognition is not dualistic at all. There's no separation at all. It's not loving kindness at that point. It's just the water that you're swimming in. You might remember some years ago we read This is Water by David Foster Wallace, and it starts with a joke. The old fish swimming along, and two young fish come up, and the old fish says to the young ones, "Hi boys, how's the water?" and they part, and one young fish says to the other, "What's water?" And we live that way too. And so the love, in this sense that I'm using it tonight, that we're moving toward, is the water that we're then swimming in. Non-separation, not kindness. Doesn't mean you can't be kind if you're a Buddha. It's just that the love is much bigger than that. You know, I love having somebody bring up what I'm hoping to talk about next. Thank you very much. In answer to your first question, no. It's a Mahayana practice. But due to our great good fortune of being born in America and having all of those divisions slowly melting away, Tonglen is something I'd like to introduce formally. Because there's various avenues to awakening, to this opening, to this recognition. Those of you who've known of Ajahn Shanti know that he uses the avenue of inquiry a lot. Like, what am I? And it's more of a mind practice and leaves some of us cold. Working with the emotions, we can get a form of inquiry that's a little less cold. Is this true? What else is true? Which comes from the trauma work, the trauma researchers. Still leaves us a little bit cold. But the avenue of Tonglen, taking and sending, is very rich, very juicy, very heart, and is a brilliant avenue for people who aren't so much mind people, that they go for the inquiry. So I found a beautiful summary of Pema Chodron's teachings on Tonglen, and I thought I would post it on the internet through our Facebook site. And if you want to read that as a preamble to, I don't know whether it's next time or down the road, but it'll give you a taste for the Tonglen, which is a brilliant, challenging, impossible practice that actually opens the heart in the same way inquiry can open the mind. By the way, in the traditional Indo-Buddhist, Indo-Tibetan cosmology, it's the heart-mind, and it sits here. Here's the brain, here's the heart-mind. So whether you enter the heart-mind more as a mind person or a heart person, inquiry or Tonglen. Then there's another avenue, and that's the avenue of devotion. And it's one that I'll talk about more, and I'll blame this on Frank, even though I'm not sure he agrees with me in talking about it. But one thing Frank taught us years ago was in his experience of working with the dying, and he was in the Zen community in San Francisco, hardcore Zen practitioners, he found that the majority of people revert to their religion of birth when they're on their deathbed. So I think it is important, given that, at least my own interpretation is that we shouldn't exclude God from our discussion. Another way of describing the same thing. But it also kind of wraps in some of the elements of the Judeo-Christian culture that most of us grew up in, whether we were active participants or sideline observers. It was the air, it was the water in which we swam in terms of a culture. So I think rather than just pushing that away as, no, I don't like that, I'm not going to go there, I think it's important to just, where it's appropriate, weave in some aspects of that. And Christianity is the epitome of a devotional path. And the devotional path opens up another whole channel. In fact, classically, it's taught that there are two channels for awakening, inquiry and devotion. Buddhism is seen as inquiry, except in a few esoteric fields like Tibetan Buddhism, where devotion practice is actually actively encouraged. But it includes all sorts of gods and demons and deities and gets a little messy. And I wouldn't encourage us to go that way, but anybody who has had an orgasm has had a moment of non-self, right? We just kind of lose ourselves for a minute. The devotional path is a direct path for losing oneself. The literature of the Christian mystics is a literature of recognizing God here, not here, but actually dissolving into the Godhead, dissolving into the God or the Goddess, becoming one with. That's the devotional path, very juicy. And it's very direct, suddenly no separation. As Meister Eckhart said, the eye through which I see God is the very eye through which God sees me. One eye, one seeing, one love. Pretty direct, no separation. So these are the three basic paths that we might work with. We've been on a path of inquiry to a great extent, and Ajah is just one of the most perfect examples of how that can be used. His question, what am I, is the best inquiry question in the whole world that I've ever run into. Tonglen is a path that is kind of a fusion between inquiry and heart. And then devotional paths are another way to go. And sometimes sound is a great opening into a devotional path, like the sound of chanting, where it just kind of melts a little bit of our own self-clinging away. So if it's not too weird, we might weave some of these different ways. We've done a lot of inquiry work. I'd like to have us return to it from time to time. Tonglen work, I think, is really worth doing. And a lot of you have had experience with it through Pema. Many of us met the Dharma through Pema. Her writings on Tonglen, I think, are the most accessible. If any of you have the old book of hers at home, Start Where You Are, she gives some really nice Tonglen instruction in that book. It's a little dicier to work on the path of devotion, but I would encourage all of you who had a devotional path at one time in your life through the Judeo-Christian traditions to not reject it. You might even feel like exploring it within the light of God not being the creator and the lawmaker, not being separate from creation. It's a very, very rich devotional path and in no way contradicts anything that the Buddha has taught us. So thanks for that question. That was a long-winded answer to it. Stalinda, I'm oriented to time and place again, or at least time. And I wanted to stop here and ask Janet to talk about the upcoming two-night retreat, because it looks like we've got some ideas about it now.
We do, and I think Gail sent out...
Today I sent out the email, so if you don't get it when you go home, when you look and you don't see it, would you let me know? You have my phone number on the Sangha list, and I'll resend it to you. So I don't want to miss anybody. There's two flyers in there and the scholarship form.
So you'll have all the information when you go home if you haven't already received it. It's going to be at N Sid Sen, which is about an hour and a half from here on Lake Coeur d'Alene, which She's a very beautiful setting. It's a Native American word for point of inspiration. So we'll be right on the lake. A vegetarian chef doing the cooking, so the food should be really good. The site is beautiful. The dining room again looks out on the lake. We'll be mainly in what's called Spirit House. You can go to the website and see all these things. But there's a deck, there's the lake, we're going to have a meeting place. The dates are September 20th, 21st, and 22nd, which is the fall equinox. Let's see. Our theme is to keep it as simple as possible. Simplicity. So we'll come into silence. We'll sit, walk, sit, eat, sit again, do movement. For really a day, how did we figure? Two nights? It comes to two full days. So any questions? What do I miss?
We are designing this to the best of our ability so that it's equally beneficial to people who have never done retreat and people who have done a lot of retreat. We'll try to touch all aspects of that.
The space is also limited. Supposed to sign up before what, September?
Well, we ask that you sign up before September 5th. But again, we have room for 30. The choice was made for 30 people. So I think there's going to be a lot of interest. I'm very excited about it myself. So if this retreat works for you, I'd really encourage you to sign up soon. Because our email list is 100, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Close to 100.
120. It will be soon.
120. So those are the numbers receiving this flyer. So if you've got a strong interest, sign up. We'll make sure you're part of it. Yes, Barbara?
Yeah, that is 20, 21, and 22 a weekend, or is that during the week?
Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday. And the fee is $150, which covers the meals, the bedding, housing, etc. And there is scholarships available. So if you want to come and you don't have all the funds to make that number, then there is a scholarship application. And if you have any questions, you can ask. Email me. My email's on the list. I'm going to be moving around for about 2 weeks, so I'll have intermittent. So be patient with me. Anna's also got her email on there. She's leaving as soon as I get back.
Uh-huh. What is the housing?
The housing, it's called Spirit House. There, it's very simple. A bed, there's two beds to each room. On the application, if you have a preference to have a room to yourself, please put it down. Also put whether it's a medical reason or a personal reason. There is another cabin, which is a very old cabin. The original cabin on the site is called the Ford Lodge or Ford Cabin. And that sleeps actually five. So we've got wiggle room to move people around. I think we're going to be able to meet people's requests. So typically, two people to the room. There's some rooms that have more, but I'm hoping we can juggle things so that not more than three people to the room.
The wish was to have it over a weekend, but this year it didn't work out that way because no weekends were available. But if it turns out and we do this again next year, how many people here, if you might raise your hand, weekend would be much better for you?
And we would maybe do it in spring, are we thinking? So that it'd be like we have our fall retreat and our spring retreat.
Huh. We didn't get that far in our discussion today.
It was a thought that flowed through the discussions, just as a possibility, or early summer or something.
So Bob's got a question.
I guess I missed it, couldn't quite hear, but I gathered you were going to try to give preference to people who've never been on a retreat before.
Thank you. Yes. To the degree that space is really limited, one of the reasons we're doing a short retreat is to make it more accessible, less intimidating, more manageable for people who've never done retreat. So, correct me if I'm wrong, Janet, but I think we were thinking that if there were a real oversubscription, we would give preference to people who had no retreat experience. Because we're, at least this year, because of the space concerns, we'll only at Cottonwood take people who have retreat experience this year. That means the reverse priority goes on in choosing who goes to Cottonwood. If you've done your first retreat as the two-night retreat in September, and then want to go to Cottonwood too, that'll be space available for you this year. We're dealing with a little bit of a space difficulty this year, hopefully not in the future. So yes, no, people who've done no retreat get preference for this one, but need retreat to do Cottonwood, and if you've just done this retreat, then you'll be space available for this year at Cottonwood. If that needs to be more confusing, I'll try to garble it better.
We do have a minimum that we need to meet of 16. Is this balance always, right?
I don't think we've got a problem. Thank you for conceiving the meetings. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it. Any other questions about the retreat, the quotes?
I'd like to just say I'm real grateful for you explaining the role of the Sangha. That I never thought about this thing. So it's actually quite a cooking place here, isn't it?
That's what it's for. It's the pot we all cook in. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for bringing that up. The Sangha is usually the unappreciated stepchild of the Dharma and the Buddha Dharma Sangha. So the three jewels, most people dismiss the Sangha as a necessary irritation. But really, it's where the work gets done. And so it's really crucial that to the degree we can, if you're committed to this process of taking the Dharma into your daily life, then showing up for Sangha, even if you never say a word, just showing up, adding your energy to the field, is really helpful for all of us.
And I wanted to say a word of gratitude to the board and to the members of the Sangha for giving me a scholarship to go to Spirit Rock next week for a week-long facilitators retreat. So I'm really looking forward to that. So thank you all.
Thank you for going.
Yes.
Are you running it? Am I running it?
No, I'm just giving you a compliment.
When she gets back, though, she'll be in charge.
The pressure's on. When we get back, we're going to expect big things.
Somebody gets to be in control.
Somebody can control this.
Bring a bag of what?
Enlightenment.
Enlightenment. Fairy dust.
Dharma dust.
Okay, well, let's sit for a while. The purpose of the closing with sitting, many purposes, but one classic teaching is that by having this silence, we allow anything that clicked or made sense to us to settle in, become more integrated, not being juggled by our concepts and not being wrestled by our emotions, but just settling in. And then at the end of this settling, it's a good idea, can be of great benefit, to make a little dedication silently that these efforts bring benefit and happiness to all beings, to relieve their suffering, to help them on their own path of awakening. Again, the dedication like this opens the field a little bit. We didn't just spend this last hour and a half for our own benefit, but rather for the benefit of all.